This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Politicians celebrate because of the new auto no-fault insurance law.
And when Governor Whitmer signed this bill, there was bipartisan high-fiving and fist-bumping and taking selfies together after passing this legislation.
Compounds derived from cannabis are popping up all over the internet.
At this point, there are food products that contain CBD. There are gummies and supplements and tinctures that contain CBD.
We'll look at tax incentives to lure business.
There's a lot that the Great Lakes Steaks have to offer outside of just financial incentives.
And an artisan talks about his craft and his customers' responses.
Serene awe that this thing is completely made of wood and it's ticking along naturally, peacefully. I love that moment. It's one of the best.
All that, plus our Friday political commentators. First, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, the CBD oil craze is upon us.
Because now CBD is FDA approved, for some indication, people are thinking, okay, where else can we use this? And how can we use it effectively?
The chemical compound, which is derived from the cannabis plant, has been touted to help everything from cancer to Crohn's disease. But what does the science show? That's later in this hour. First, the Mackinac Policy Conference on Mackinac Island wrapped up today. It's the annual gathering of business leaders, politicians, policy wonks, activists, and a whole bunch of reporters. It's put together by the Detroit Regional Chamber. Our political analysts, Zoe Clark, and Capitol reporter Rick Pluta were there. They join us now to talk about what happened and what they're keeping their eye on. Hi there, you two.
Hey.
Hello, Lester.
First things first, Governor Gretchen Whitmer signed the auto no-fault insurance legislation. What should we expect from that new law?
Well, you know, we'll have to wait to see how it plays out. But what it does essentially is it allows people to choose levels of coverage instead of the existing system, which says that if you are injured in a car crash, that you get unlimited benefits. And what this does is it requires that people who are injured to coordinate with other types of coverage. And the goal is to bring down Michigan's very often highest in the nation auto insurance premiums.
So that is, of course, the policy of what this bill will do. And I think what a lot of Capitol reporters are wondering up here is what the political ramifications will be, because let's just say this, it was an incredibly historic bill. For decades, Lansing has been trying to overhaul some of, you know, Michigan's highest in the nation auto insurance rates. And when Governor Whitmer signed this bill, there was bipartisan bromancing happening and woman sistermancing happening. I mean, it was amazing to see these lawmakers high-fiving and fist-bumping and taking selfies together after passing this legislation. And so what'll be interesting politically to see is, well, what does this do for the environment going forward? As, of course, there are still big issues on the table. The budget, the state budget, and, of course, road funding.
I want to talk about that bipartisan cooperation, but before we get there, one insurance industry official has indicated that this law might not lower insurance rates. In fact, it might even cause rates to go up. How's that going over at the Mackinac Conference?
Well, I mean, there's this question of whether or not there will be a bleed over effect, that parts of your insurance bill will definitely go down. And the question is whether the way that the insurance industry works, and I'm not an expert in this, that will basically have an effect on other parts of people's insurance bills. And we should also point out that even though this bill has been signed into law, that it will almost certainly, at least parts of it, be challenged in court by trial attorneys and victims and victims' rights advocates.
And of course, much of it does not go into effect for another year.
So this bipartisan cooperation you were talking about on the auto no-fault law, is that going to be the model process as Governor Whitmer has suggested?
Well, I asked Governor Whitmer that, in fact, today. I said, look, you have been around Lansing. You were in the legislature for more than a decade. Is this going to continue? Well, first, she said that this has been, you know, just this past 5 months, some of the most bipartisan ship that she has seen since her years in Lansing. And she also said really what it has to do is with relationships, and that building relationships and understanding where people are coming from has just been huge. And so I think she's hoping, would like it to continue to get stuff done. But as I said, there is the budget, there is road funding, and those are some issues that Democrats and Republicans disagree on.
You know, there is certainly this speculation about whether this will serve as a template for resolving other thorny questions. But the Senate Majority Leader, Mike Shirkey, in particular, made clear that these issues are going to be resolved a case-by-case basis, and that we should be careful about assuming that there's going to be too much linkage on all of this.
I also think there's this interesting dynamic, too, where Speaker of the House Lee Chatfield was speaking yesterday about this, that they are very proud of the fact that they are not operating like Washington, D.C. I cannot tell you how many times I have heard the speaker say, you know, we're not like D.C. here in Lansing. You know, here in Michigan, we are getting things done bipartisan. You know, they know they are doing this, and they also want to talk it up because I think they believe that this is what voters want.
There's a dynamic playing out, again, in particular, between Mike Shirkey and the governor, that when he talks about Gretchen Whitmer, there's a very deferential tone to it. He calls her my governor, that when my governor wants to talk, I will always be there for my governor. And he's clearly making a point as powerfully as he can about at least a willingness to work together.
Let's talk about the roads, one of the thorny issues that you were talking about. The governor wants to raise the gas tax by 45 cents a gallon or an equivalent. She says she'll consider other plans as long as the state brings in $2.5 billion a year more. She wants it done as part of the state's budget. The Republicans are saying budget first, road deal later. What's the buzz at Mackinac?
Well, I mean, what we're hearing directly is the governor says two things. First of all, that they're linked, they're entwined, that you can't do the budget without doing road funding, that they're both part and parcel. And she did say that she's willing to look at other proposals, but right now there are no other proposals on the table. So it's basically she put the ball in the Republicans' court and said, if you've got an alternative, bring it to the table for discussion. Right now there is no alternative plan.
Where you're sitting right now is really close to where the 66-year-old Line 5 pipelines go under the Straits of Mackinac. Attorney General Dana Nessel said if the state and the Canadian pipeline company Enbridge don't reach an agreement on a tunnel plan for the pipeline in 30 days, she'll start the process to shut Line 5 down. What's been the response to that?
That one is really, really interesting, and we're seeing what almost seems to be a good cop, bad cop play here with Gretchen Whitmer and Attorney General Nessel, that the governor is saying, well, let's wait, let's talk some more, let's see what we can accomplish in negotiations, but still hanging out there is the possibility of legal action from the Attorney General.
Although I was talking with someone that if you had a dollar for every time you heard the word lockstep from them, you would be a rich person, that they are very clear that they are working together on this, right? This is not an undercover good cop, bad cop. They are kind of going, you know, against this or trying to figure this out very much together. And we heard back from Enbridge. We spoke with the governor just this morning who said, you know, look forward again for the next month because she is meeting with Enbridge officials on their next set of negotiations next week.
And before we get off that topic, we should note Enbridge is a sponsor of Michigan Radio. I read that Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey proposed a ballot initiative in 2021 that would challenge term limits. Despite studies that reveal term limits are not accomplishing what its supporters thought it would, it still remains very popular among voters. What makes Senator Shirkey think they'll vote to end term limits?
Well, I'm not so much sure that he said people will vote to end term limits. He said he wants to have discussions about them. In fact, Lee Chatfield, his fellow Republican Speaker of the House, basically said, look, if you put a ballot initiative right now that says end term limits, Chatfield said people are going to vote it down. So Chatfield added, you know, maybe you need something like good government or some kind of ethics reform as part of it and turn it into a whole package. But I think what's coming from this, right, is this idea that Shirky and Lee Chatfield and Christine Gregg, the Democratic leader of the House, were talking about the fact that, you know, these folks get here, they're just learning how to do politics. They're just learning how to pass bills and procedures, and they're already out of office. Lee Chatfield, the Speaker of the House, right? The Speaker of the Michigan House has only spent 5 years in Lansing. And he said, I'm just figuring out how to do this and I'm going to be out. And the next person is going to come back in.
He's not the first Speaker of the House to say something like that. And we've heard that before.
He's not. Well, because he's not the first Speaker of the House who's been on year, you know, 4 or 5, taking over as Speaker and then is pushed out. And look, you can understand where voters are coming from, right? That it feels like, well, you know, if folks get too used to, you know, Lansing, that they don't end up working hard enough, or it's, you know, it becomes too friendly and things like that. But the opposite side is, well, then what you have is lobbyists who kind of run the show sometime, and folks who are kind of telling these newbie lawmakers, here's how things work. And by the time they understand what's going on, they're out of there.
And we should be clear about this. The majority leader did not throw out a specific proposal. He said that he wants to study the question and find out some way to either extend term limits, to eliminate term limits, but he's not set on a particular course at this time. However, because it is an amendment to the state constitution, it would have to be ratified by voters if this were to happen.
What else was the talk of the town at the Mackinac Policy Conference?
I think you kind of covered it. The substantive action here was the auto insurance overhaul, but the bombshell was, you know, legislative leaders saying, we really want to get active in doing something about term limits. And those are the things that are really the talk of the island, along with whether or not what we saw happen with auto insurance is indicative of what we're going to see as far as cooperation between the Republican leadership and the legislature and Governor Whitmer, who's a Democrat. I will say a lot of people are suggesting that the window to do anything is very, very short because we're going to have elections next year. And two, because of a federal court ruling, that we may see redrawing of district lines happening very, very, very soon. Also, this is the first conference since we've had this new leadership assuming control in the legislature, since this new governor assumed office. And so this is always the nice conference.
Well, here's your annual reminder. Don't forget to pick up some Mackinac Island souvenirs or at least some fudge for all of us back here.
Duly noted.
Our bags are full.
Zoe Clark is our resident political junkie. Rick Pluta covers the Capitol for Michigan Radio. Thanks, you two.
You bet.
Thanks, Lester.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We've been traveling over a good portion of Michigan to find people making the things we use. We call the series Artisans of Michigan. This time, we visit Kalamazoo. The tick-tock sound you hear on this promotional video is a large clock unlike any you've seen before. It is a sculpture in motion made of Michigan hardwoods. The clockmaker, designer, builder is Rick Hale with Clockrite.
With these clocks, I try to combine two elements, one being curved, organic visual shapes that sort of define the general shape of the piece, and that is in tandem with kind of the fine detail, the small gear teeth, the tiny ticking levers and parts. So it's kind of a combination of those two things.
Except for some, like, bushings, these gears are made of wood.
Yep, it's taken a lot of trial and error to come up with ways to work with wood as a medium and to overcome some of the pitfalls that can crop up with warping and just movement over time. But at this point, I'm very confident in my process and my product.
So how did you come to the decision, I want to make wood clocks?
It was kind of a strange path. The short answer is old books. That was about 6 or 7 years ago that I first started reading about clocks and just mechanics in general. It turned out I had kind of a latent interest that I didn't discover until after I got my English degree. But after I started reading those books, I realized I was just enamored by these complex, self-contained little universes of mechanisms, and from there, I just started experimenting and getting into woodworking and eventually combined the two.
You mentioned that there's a sculptural aspect to the clocks, and there is. It's beautiful. A lot of moving parts, some of the big moving parts, but no numbers on your clocks. Explain your concept behind that.
I try to avoid a traditional dial or numbers, as you say, because generally with my pieces, my favorite thing about them and about what they do to a space or to a person is they create this sense of calm, tranquility as far as the way time passes. And I really like that. That's part of what made me want to build a really large clock in the first place. I wanted a large pendulum because it would swing very slowly. And so I find that removing the numbers still allows the clock to tell the time with the hands, if you really want to know. But the overall sense in the room is that this is just a moving, sort of living piece that's made from organic materials and just creates a feeling before it actually tells you the traditional time.
Rick Hale started college studying music. He was a jazz musician, still is. Then he switched his major to English. But somewhere along the line, he realized he didn't really want to teach.
Well, it was kind of a strange time in my life, honestly. So there was a year where a lot was going on with my family. My dad passed, and he'd been in the hospital for a while, off and on. And it was obviously, you know, just very stressful and very new for me and my sister and my mom. And so it was kind of this time where I felt like drastic change was possible. It just felt feasible in some way that I could totally change everything I'm doing and it would be fine. It was almost as a means of coping. The first clock I made, which was horrible, and each tooth was hand cut on a scroll saw and it barely worked at all, I made that in the weeks following his death. So it was kind of in the very beginning just a way of working through that and finding a way to simultaneously distract myself and give myself some space for self-reflection and thinking, well, I can keep my hands busy, kind of a thing.
One of the things I like to ask artisans is whether they're actually making a living doing what they love. Almost all of them do, but some admit that they've sacrificed a larger income for the satisfaction of their craft. Rick Hale says he wasn't doing all that well at first, but he did a Kickstarter. Friends and family crowdfunded the venture. Then he started meeting watch collectors and clock collectors, and things just clicked. It's paying off, but his clocks are not cheap.
So if I wanted, I don't know, the cheapest one of these clocks you make, how much am I going to have to shell out?
So that's a very good question. The price does generally vary a lot depending on complexity, the type of wood that the client wants, and size especially, because there's a huge range with the gear sizes and the overall footprint of the clock. But generally these days, for a custom piece that's designed just for a specific space, a smaller clock would start around $24,000, and for a much larger one, it could be around $50,000 to $60,000. And the reason for that is one custom piece can take me almost a year. It's a very slow process. Not only does each gear have to be made individually, each tooth has to be made individually and then inserted into each gear. So there's a lot that goes into these pieces. And even for a small custom piece, generally I'd put in about 800 to 900 hours of work. So that gives you an idea of why the prices are where they're at.
Rick Hale says he can get those prices because these clocks are also works of art. With a cell phone in your pocket, you know exactly what time it is, right? So these clocks do tell time, but mechanical clocks are basically obsolete. That frees him from function dictating form. He says he's making clocks that change the way people feel the passage of time.
After all the work that goes into one of these hundreds of hours, it's always great for me to see it ticking, first of all. But then after all the testing is done, and I'm sure that it's good, seeing the client watch it ticking for the first time is just one of the best feelings in the world, because it's this look of just kind of a mixture of awe and I don't even know how to describe it. It's just kind of this serene awe that this thing is completely made of wood and it's ticking along naturally, peacefully. I love that moment. It's one of the best.
That promotional video we mentioned earlier is up on our website, michiganradio.org. You can actually see one of the large clocks in motion and better understand what he's talking about. Rick Hale, clockmaker with clockright.com,
He's our latest Artisan of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. The Food and Drug Administration held a hearing today on CBD, an extract of the cannabis plant. The FDA wants to collect more information about CBD, which is already found in products such as candy, oils, drinks, and even dog food. CBD is becoming popular for treating things such as chronic pain and other ailments, despite confusion about its legal status. Joining us to talk about that is Kevin Banky. He's the researcher at the Department of Anesthesiology and the Chronic Pain and Fatigue Research Center at the University of Michigan Medical School. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
First, tell us what CBD is.
So CBD is cannabidiol. It's a non-intoxicating component in the cannabis plant. And at this point, there's a lot of excitement about it, as you said, about its therapeutic potential. And a lot of this is coming into place after the FDA-approved Epidiolex, a CBD-based product for childhood epileptic disorders like Dravet syndrome. So because it was shown to be effective in that, there's now a lot more opportunities for people to use it at this point. Not necessarily the Epidiolex itself because it's so expensive, but because now CBD is FDA approved for some indication, people are thinking, okay, where else can we use this and how can we use it effectively?
One of the big questions is, in Michigan, is CBD oil or CBD products of any kind, is it legal?
Kind of. It's really a squishy space to be in. So if CBD is coming from hemp, the cannabis plant that has less than 0.3% THC in it.
Which then, is the intoxicant.
Yep, exactly. Then it may be legal. In the 2018 Farm Bill that was recently signed, industrial hemp production was legalized. But how that's going to be regulated, the FDA hasn't really weighed in a very strong way. So they're taking public comments about it. But at this point, there are food products that contain CBD. There are gummies and supplements and tinctures that contain CBD. And there's just so much swirling around. And it's also a very lucrative market. So we have all these forces at play that are complicating the situation.
It's Wild West right now.
Absolutely.
What do we actually know about CBD as a medication?
It's a great question. Like I mentioned, so the FDA did approve CBD for childhood epileptic disorders. That being said, in terms of other conditions that there are many of these claims about, the body of research is quite limited. So at least in humans, in terms of animal studies, cell studies, CBD does seem to have anti-inflammatory activity. It does seem to be a useful agent in arthritis. And in a few studies in humans, it seems to have anti-anxiety properties, but those are high-dose, single-dose studies. So people given CBD once and seeing what happens.
So not a lot of research.
Not a lot of research.
Not enough research anyway. And years away from FDA approval, because that takes a long time. That's a process in itself.
Likely, yeah. It's also the type of thing, though, that because there's all that preclinical research where the mechanisms of action seem to be promising, people have been saying, well, because CBD is for a long time has been a Schedule I substance because it comes from the cannabis plant, this lack of research has actually clamped down the what we could know about the therapeutic benefits of this compound. And so similarly to what happened and is what is still happening in the medical cannabis space, we're in this position where the policy about the access to CBD and medical cannabis, for that matter, is so far ahead of the science. So as scientists, we're kind of scrambling to catch up to do the best that we can.
How much is the opioid crisis contributing to this interest in CBD?
I think it's contributing quite substantially for a couple reasons. So one, just the human cost of the opioid crisis is so horrific that people want to find something that they can do in its place. And two, many of the chronic pain medications and interventions that a lot of people use either are expensive or not accessible. So things like, you know, good physical therapy, massage, acupuncture, yoga, things that are evidence-based, there's issues with access and out-of-pocket expense. In terms of medications, those come with pretty significant side effects a lot of times. So opioids, obviously, overdose and death. But a lot of other medications, too, they have effects on mood, on appetite, on just all kinds of things as well as pain. And they don't work that well in every individual. So people are still going to, you know, have to figure out what's best for them and often end up taking multiple medications. So when you have compounds like CBD that are available that are known to be quite well tolerated and fairly safe in a lot of people, we end up in this situation where, you know, people out of desperation want to go for compounds like CBD. The other thing is, on the opioid side of things, there's actually a clinical trial that came out just a few days ago that found that people who are recovering from heroin addiction, so an opioid, obviously, when they are given high doses of CBD, that seems to reduce some of their cravings for heroin. And so part of this emerging body of research that's coming out that people are so excited about, because if CBD has this therapeutic potential and it has few side effects, this is a really wonderful substance that people could potentially use. And I think what's happening is many people are just jumping the gun and going into that as a DIY situation.
And that brings me to this question. I'm sure a lot of people are asking their physicians about it. What are physicians recommending at this point?
So that depends a lot on the physician. I'm not a physician. I'm a PhD. But my stance at this point when I talk to many physicians is, let's go with a harm reduction situation. So we know that CBD is well tolerated, but we also want to make sure that people are using it in a responsible way. Starting with a low dose of a product that is known to be certified for safety and potency. So we know what's in it in terms of, yes, the CBD matches what the claim is, as well as it doesn't have heavy metals, pesticides, etc. We suggest doing that if the patient is going to do it. And we also really suggest keeping an open line of communication between the patient and physician, because that's the basis of a successful relationship there. And I mentioned the safety and potency issue because just recently a news report came out stating that many, many CBD products are contaminated either with heavy metals, with pesticides, with solvents from the extraction process. And so because this is such a Wild West situation, it's really important that people are using a product that they know what's in it.
But how would you know? I mean, is there some place that's actually certifying them, saying this, we've tested it, this batch is great, and there's no problems with it, or is it we're just relying that the label's right?
So that's where the independent third-party testing is really important. So companies that they send their products out to somebody who's not internal, and that produces a certificate of analysis that indeed shows you all of those things. But, you know, because it is a Wild West situation, I mean, you can go on Amazon and get hundreds of products of different products, and it's just a difficult place to be as a consumer as well, and as a physician for that matter, because if the patient comes in and says, hey, I want to try CBD, unlike a pharmaceutical where a doctor can say, okay, let's go with this one. It's gone through all the FDA testing. It has the good manufacturing practices, all that stuff. They just don't have that for CBD in the same way.
So some NFL players are pushing for the league to loosen up the rules to allow CBD. Battered football players want access to it because of the claims about the substance. It's said that CBD can do everything from preventing seizures to treating all these kinds of chronic pain issues. Why is it so popular among them?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons for this. One is that these athletes, their bodies go through an incredible amount of trauma. You know, the practice that they do, the hits that they take on the field mean that many of them have lifelong injuries. And to stay in the game, a lot of the time, many of them are given painkillers, including opioids. And I think many of the retired athletes, I've spoken to a couple, but in the news that I've seen about it, many of them say, you know, this game really took it out of my body. And the medications made things worse. I couldn't feel what was happening. So I would push past my limits, do whatever it is. And CBD doesn't have that kind of side effect profile. As we've talked about, it's pretty well tolerated and it's not intoxicating. So I think there's that aspect of things. And then also just the mechanistic side of things. We know that CBD has many of these effects in non-human studies. And so people are thinking, okay, let's just see what's possible there.
Gets back to that desperation you were talking
about. Gets back to that desperation, exactly. And I think lastly, the fact that cannabis is becoming increasingly legal throughout the country in many of these states that do have football teams. And because of that, I think there's kind of a mismatch between the NFL policy of, you know, nobody can use this versus the state policy where people can get a license and then go to a dispensary or grow their own cannabis. It's kind of the situation that's playing out throughout the country, but in that microcosm of these athletes who, you know, suffer from a lot of pain.
Sounds like we've got a lot to learn yet.
Yes, we do.
That is Kevin Behnke. He's a researcher in the Anesthesiology Department and Chronic Pain and Fatigue Research Center at the University of Michigan Medical School. We've been talking about CBD. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham.
Do tax incentives work to draw business and create jobs to the point states actually recoup the investment and bring in more tax revenue? Well, the answer is it depends on the incentive. When cities like Detroit and states like Michigan are foregoing millions or tens of millions of dollars in tax revenue, or in a couple of cases preparing to offer incentives in the billions of dollars, a lot of folks wonder what in the world are people in government thinking? I was reading in Governing Magazine about some recent research out of North Carolina State University, which looked at all of the incentives offered by 32 states from 1990 to 2015. That basically covers 90% of incentives for the whole nation. Leading that research was Bruce McDonald, an associate professor at North Carolina State, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what did you want to learn with this research?
Our goal was to really get an understanding of how financial incentives impact fiscal health. We know quite a bit about what drives a state's fiscal health, but in terms of kind of understanding that impact of financial incentives, we really don't know too much. The literature and the previous research out there on financial incentives has been predominantly focused on the economic side of things, and even that's relatively sparse. Yet states have a tendency to make these large offerings, and so we really just kind of wanted to understand what kind of impact those offerings really do have for the people and the governments that offer them.
So people haven't actually looked very carefully about whether there's even economic benefit with these incentives?
Unfortunately, they haven't. There's been some studies over the years that have looked at different aspects. Usually they focus on a part of the product that the incentive brought into the state. Did it impact the employment level? You know, something kind of along that kind of line. But they are one-off situations rather than a broad understanding of what the incentives actually do for the economy.
So in that case, what kind of factors did you use in determining whether incentives work?
So what we did is we looked at four different categories of factors that are going to drive a state's fiscal health. This would be the governmental characteristics of the state, the political environment of the state, its economic environment, as well as its demographic characteristics. And then we then kind of imposed the financial incentives onto that set of factors in order to derive out the impactors that the incentives are having.
Well, let's jump to the bad part. What sort of incentives seem to be the worst kind of government investment in private enterprise?
Unfortunately, it tends to be the incentives that are related to research and development projects.
So like tax credits.
Exactly, which are things that we would usually kind of expect. We have a hope that R&D projects are going to have a large payoff. But if we think about what types of businesses and types of projects are done on the R&D side, there's a huge risk for the business as well. And so that risk really can be pushed back over to the government side. That is, they're costing the state fairly significantly in terms of their fiscal health and stability.
You also noted that property tax abatements weren't all that great.
Right. So if we think about property taxes, we can use the abatements to make it a little bit more feasible for somebody to come into our communities. But that's also a large chunk of revenue that local governments and state governments rely upon for their budgets. When things go bad financially for the state, it's property tax, which is going to be the most stable form of revenue. And so we're basically removing that stability that the state has to rely on. So ultimately, it does have a fairly negative impact for the state.
A lot of state incentives are tied to job creation, although Michigan has failed in follow-ups on some of those incentives. That is, they didn't always claw back the incentives when the jobs never materialized. What did your research reveal about job creation tax breaks?
Job creation tax credits are probably the one unique area of financial incentives that actually pays off for the state. And part of that is when the state is incentivizing business to employ more people, there's an immediate payback to the state itself in terms of income tax revenue coming in. We've removed the person perhaps off of whatever state-funded programs they've been on in the meantime. And so there's a fairly direct and fairly significant impact that the job creation tax credits have that no other form of incentive really does.
I probably should have asked you this earlier, but of the 32 states, was Michigan included?
Michigan was included. So Michigan overall is a kind of middle-of-the-ground state in terms of financial health. You know, not doing great, but it's also not necessarily doing too bad.
There's the argument that government incentives are not the highest priority for corporations. They look at things like whether there's a skilled labor pool, the cost of labor, the corporate tax rate, quality of life in a community. All of those things seem to be more important according to one ranking. Are states putting too much emphasis on incentives?
That's a tough question to answer. We know businesses pay attention to the incentives, and all things being equal, the incentives can be the determining factor. We think of an instance like Amazon HQ2 from last year. One of the factors that got incorporated into it was Amazon was going around looking at the quality of life, looking at the environment as well, because they want to be able to bring people in to work in that area for the company. But as New York found out when they pushed back on kind of saying, we're not going to give you the incentives like we had thought we would be able to, you know, Amazon had the capacity to pick up and leave. And so it might not be the only factor, but it is certainly a factor for the business as well.
So we talked about job creation tax breaks. What are some of the best kinds of incentives a state could offer that would pay off in a good return on investment and keep the state healthy?
Unfortunately, the only one that does have a payback for the state is the job creation tax credit.
Huh. So bottom line it for us, are states and cities competing with each other to attract these businesses to their own detriment?
Oh, absolutely. I think part of it is the argument that politicians feel like if they don't go into the competition, the public is going to be displeased with the job that they're doing. And so that we almost kind of, from the political standpoint, have to do the incentive. But that at the same time, it is hurting the people back in the states and the districts where they are from. And so maybe it's not necessarily the best idea for them to do in the first place.
What do you think would happen if a state decided, you know, we're going to rein in everything except for these job creation tax credits? Would that work?
I think depending on the state, it would help. And so the largest amount of tax credits that we see typically take place are along the East Coast, where you have states heavily competing for businesses that need some type of international access. So North Carolina versus South Carolina for auto industry, for example, or North and South Carolina versus Alabama, where there's an ocean where they can ship the cars and vehicles out, bring in the parts they need, but it also gives them access around the United States. And so it wouldn't necessarily require one state to kind of stop offering incentives. You would need to have several of these major players to stop offering incentives.
We've seen some regions in a state that will work together. Several towns or several counties would work together and not compete against each other for the same thing, that thinking that the just drawing the plant to the region would be beneficial for everyone, right? So Could states do that? Can you imagine, Great Lakes states binding together and saying, look, you want to put a plant here, that's great. We're not going to compete with each other to do that, though.
I think it would be a good thing for them to do that. There's a lot that the Great Lakes states have to offer outside of just financial incentives. You know, there's an amazing workforce. You have a great climate. You have strong cities. You have a fairly vibrant culture. You know, things that large businesses are looking for when they're trying to make those decisions on where to locate. And so saying, you know, here's the rest of us, let's pay attention to that, can still appeal back to some of the businesses as they're trying to make that decision on where to locate or where to expand to.
Well, I'm always a skeptic. I can't imagine that actually happening, but I like the sound of it anyway. Bruce McDonald is an associate professor at North Carolina State. He was the leader of a research team looking at the value of tax breaks and other incentives to lure or retain businesses. Thanks for telling us about your research.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
The subject of fixing the roads, how much money is needed, where that money is coming from, is debated everywhere from the Capitol to coffee shops. It seems a lot of people have a lot of ideas, and frankly, most of them are not feasible. Here to talk about roads and money are our Friday political commentators that are going to have all the answers for us. Vicki Burnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. All right, let's talk about the numbers first. The Michigan Department of Transportation budget is just under $5 billion. Some of that money, about 11% of it, goes to airports, railroad infrastructure, and public transit. That leaves you with about $4.5 billion for planning, administration, state and local roads and bridges. Vicki, someone asked, why do we need a gas tax increase? Isn't the tax on marijuana going to pay for those roads?
No, it's not going to pay for the roads. And It's like the same thing I hear from people about the lottery money going into the school aid fund. It all does. But when we talk about roads, they're expensive things. And expensive things cost a lot of money, and people just don't quite have a grasp on how much money that is. And that's part of the disconnect between trying to figure out how to pay for roads and people understanding how much they actually cost.
Yeah, when it was a ballot initiative, I think Anderson Consultant said after the marijuana industry is matured, they'll bring in about $175 million in tax revenue, but only about $15 million of that would be earmarked for roads. So $15 million out of a $4.5 billion budget, that's not going to go very far. Ken, when you start talking about billions of dollars, I think a lot of people get confused about the scale of the cost of road maintenance. I mean, when you were in office, how did you explain to your constituents how you spent billions of dollars on the roads, but there were still potholes?
Well, I think you always have to have an ear to public opinion, but I also want to point out that in a representative democracy, you know, voters send people to Lansing and Washington to address issues that demand attention. And I sort of want to, I guess, argue against any premise that the public should be able to prescribe the exact solution in exact terms to fundamental problems. That isn't what they're supposed to be doing. I mean, they go out and live their lives. And, you know, so if they don't quite grasp the magnitude of a problem, but they still recognize there's a problem, I think that's kind of good enough for legislators, whether in Washington or Lansing, to then solve it.
Do you think the state does a bad job of telling people where their tax dollars go? I mean, the lottery has done such a good job of telling people where the proceeds go to schools. In fact, a lot of people think the lottery money completely pays for the schools. So should Michigan do like other states and put up big signs saying this highway paving paid with your fuel taxes or your vehicle registration money? Vicki?
Well, I think there's two problems here. One is, as Ken pointed out, you can't expect everybody who's not in government to understand how government budgets work, because they don't work like your own personal checking accounts and savings accounts at home. You can't just move money from one account to another so that you can pay your bills this month and take it out of savings and move it somewhere else. That's not how government money works. And there's very clear reasons for that. So road money that comes in from the federal government has to go to roads and bridges, just like the earmarked money from gas tax and everything else has to go into roads and bridges. So you can't just take money if you have extra money left over in, let's say, bovine TB revenue or costs or savings from the budget and move it into roads. They're very specific pipelines, and that's hard for people to get their arms around when their home accounting doesn't work like that. In addition, things are very expensive. I remember when I was mayor and I was asked, can't we just put a street light on that corner? And I had to explain to people that putting a street light on a corner was close to $200,000, even though the light itself may be $20,000. And the reason is there's no plug there. So every time government has to do a project, it has to move all of the infrastructure into that area in order to make it work. And roads, building new roads is the same way. And totally re-engineering roads may mean that you have to buy right-of-way, and that's buying people's property, and that costs money. So roads are very complicated when you start to talk about actually how does money get into the fund and how is it used.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what people think, because a report from the Center for Michigan released this week found that people generally thought there should be more money spent on the roads. Not the $2.5 billion that the governor wants, but maybe $1 billion. That should do it. And the state can find that money by cutting out waste, fraud, and abuse. Problem solved. Ken, what do you think of that plan?
Well, I'll go back to what I had said earlier. The outline of the report from the Center for Michigan basically said that the public believes the roads are bad, they're getting worse, and the state should spend more to fix them. I think that's enough for legislators to and governors to be about the business of finding the resources and raising the tax revenue to fix the roads. I think it's a kind of an unfair expectation that the public's going to have a grasp of the difference between $1 billion and $2 billion when it comes to the road issue. That's not what you should expect in a representative democracy. The fact that the public believes the roads are bad, they realize that it's going to take money to fix them, is enough to get things moving.
Vicki, these people do have an idea. This billion-dollar plan and finding it in the waste in government is something that they really held on to. A lot of people in this report indicated that that was a good plan. Well, what's wrong with that plan?
The main thing wrong with that plan is that the size of state government has not grown financially since the turn of the century. So we are operating with about the same amount of money right now as we had in the year 2000. In accounting for inflation, it means that we are really spending very, very few dollars compared to what we used to spend. And in fact, we are very far below the Headley cap that was once reached under Governor Engler, and now we're several billion dollars below that Headley cap. So there is room to grow taxes in the state of Michigan. I don't think it's just enough that people know there's a problem and know that they want to have it fixed. I think there needs to be a general understanding with the public that the legislature needs to go out and have courage to raise funding for roads. But if they need to go to the voters are going to have to be educated. If it's a sales tax increase, the voters are going to need to vote on that, and they're going to have to understand how that money is going to come in and how that's going to be spent. So I think we do need to do a lot of education with our voters so that they understand what the magnitude of the problem is. And I'll tell you, we're one collapsed bridge with several deaths away from everybody sitting down and getting darn serious about the status of our roads in the state of Michigan.
This whole waste, fraud, abuse idea. I mean, like, we've had 8 years of complete Republican control. If waste, fraud, and abuse hasn't been squeezed out of government at this point, it either isn't there or you can't find it. And any Republican legislator who starts throwing that around, they've got to answer why they haven't taken it out in the last 8 years.
All right, lightning round now. We've got final question. Are we going to see a fix the roads package out of the legislature that will bring in enough money to actually fix the roads? Ken?
Well, I don't know. I think we should. I think we'll see something. But my crystal ball can't answer your question about whether it's going to be enough to stop the deterioration and really improve the situation. I just don't know.
Vicki?
No, I don't think we're going to get up to the number that we need, unless we're really serious about also having a broad-based income tax increase. When we cut taxes 10 years ago, we cut $1.8 billion out of the tax revenue stream in Michigan, which could have been used to fix the roads had we been more creative with what we were doing.
Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. Thanks for the conversation, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Next week on Stateside, we hear about an effort in Kalamazoo to bring theater to life for people with visual impairments.
The thing that I love about audio description is it's a creative process, just like theater.
That's Monday on Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening today. Have a great weekend.